a linear amplifier in order to bring it up to the 100 watts in your station. But other than that, I think it's a very well designed. I'm a big fan of software defined radios. 705 is inherently a modern design of software defined radio. The only limitation, again, is that on battery power, it will only put out 5 watts, and with a power supply, it'll put out 10 watts, because the power supply is capable of higher current draw.
Thank you. Thank you for answering this question. I was planning to get something mobile too, so I can just pick it up and go hike a little. For my desktop station, I might have to look for the standard for the different
sections. Yeah, the 7300, as far as I'm aware, is an excellent radio. I joke that about every 10 years, there's a radio that every other guy that you make a contact with owns. About 20 years ago, it was the ICOM 706. 10 years ago, it was the Kenwood TS-2000. I knew one great guy who used to be a host here on the Technical Net, who owns 5 TS-2000. But the last few years, the go-to radio where you ask the guy what kind of radio he's using, very often you will say an ICOM 7300. Of course, the downside with the 7300 is it does not operate in UHF-VHF, but if you happen to already have a UHF-VHF radio, that isn't the real downside. My radio that I'm operating right now for the sake of the technical mess is my ICOM 7100, which is an all-in-one. But, there's no law that you have to have an all-in-one. It just makes things more compact. But if you have a UHF, VHF antenna that you like, then you don't necessarily need an all-in-one. And as I said, the 7300, I've only known one person who traded it in for something else. Most people have been very happy with it.
Thank you for answering my question.
Okay, very good, Ivan. You know where to find us if you have any further. If anyone else has any opinions about what I said or the question that Ivan made, feel free to comment. Okay, Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, Troy, okay. If somebody had any radio questions, I was going to ask about one of the things on your list on the Roy.AC2GS website. You had a story about vitamin D. People are overweight, maybe it's not working too good. You got that from, I think, from the Gizmo site. I wonder if you agree with that. It looks like it's a study, you know. And also, they even mentioned the fish pills that people say, the omega. I mean, if that's true, I would think that would be like breaking news, on Nano or something. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, it is an article out of Gizmodo, although I'm sure other places have written about it. It's based on analysis of a rather large-scale project called the Vital Trial. Of course, that doesn't prove it. It's an interesting finding that needs to be repeatedly correlated and make sure that it's legit and just not a statistical aberration. As unfortunately, too many things like that tend to be. Eventually, as the studies accrue, results kind of shift out of the gee-whiz zone into the not much of anything zone. So it's interesting at this time whether anyone should make any significant changes based upon it. Dubious. Three omega oils have been particularly problematic. People have legitimately been advised that certain fish fats, like three omega, are beneficial for people with cholesterol and such. The problem is the way that people are trying to solve that problem is to just kind of take one pill. Three omega oil is not a supplement. It's not a vitamin. It's not something that is required in small amounts to have their benefits. Three omega oil is a type of fat that should be a portion, a significant, you know, not maximum, but a significant portion of your daily intake of fat should be something close to three omega oil. Taking one or two capsules will give you a psychological benefit, but really shouldn't shift your triglycerides or your cholesterol by anything significant. So I think it's more of a problem of getting the information across legitimately to people. And of course, the vitamin industry is more than happy to package little pill shapes filled with three omega oil and suggest things just randomly. So I think the part about the three omega oil is something that medicine has known about for 20 years and has kind of grown tired of complaining about to people because no one kind of listens.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Yeah, I get it. No problem. I'll keep my eye on that story. So, yeah, it doesn't look like it's written in stone right now. But interesting. You know, especially the article, you know, if you're a little overweight, maybe no good. Underweight, no problem. I mean, that's the way they don't say that, but that's the way they come off when I read it. Anyway, back to your work.
Yeah, there has been a general public relations push for weighing less and less and less. You'll notice if you look at the historical trends, the recommended weight ranges tend to be getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And the benefits of being, kind of skinny is consistent and kind of against, unfortunately, American culture. We're a chubby people. And probably if we could lose all that, the amount of time and money and effort and problems related to hypertension and diabetes and heart disease and a whole bunch of other things would plummet. But the hardest thing I found, it's not that easy to get people to actually take pills. Very often I will have people bring me their pill bottle, and it should be empty and it's half full. So that's a problem. But having people change their lifestyles is incredibly difficult. And, if someone finally figures that one out, then they'll get three Nobel Prize. One of the newest things that I've mentioned in my link repeatedly are different anti-diabetic medications that have been found to be appetite suppressants without the side effects of stimulants like amphetamine. And so they've presented weight changes, weight loss. The problem is taking that medicine is expensive. It could be thousands of dollars a month. Insurance companies will pay for diabetes medication for the most part. They don't really want to pay for making...
Okay, that was in the news recently, too. The diabetic medicine, they're doubling the doses to give the people who lose weight. Wow. Well, part of the problem is New York. You know, you got the best food in the world in the New York area. You know, plus all the fast foods together. You know, it's almost lost cause. Anyway, people really wasn't about losing weight. Basically, they were saying, you know, lose weight and then maybe the vitamin D would be more effective. I don't know. Why don't the people just take twice the amount of vitamin D? I guess you can't do that. Anyway, back to you, Roy. I'll stand by.
Well, yeah, if they convince more people to lose weight, that would ultimately be a lot more beneficial than people just doubling up on their vitamins. But you can do that too, but still, that would solve one problem, whereas losing weight would probably solve a couple of dozen problems. So, you know, unfortunately, it's very difficult to talk people into changing their lifestyle. I understand. I'm a human being as well. I have my little foibles. But still, it makes practicing medicine a challenge. So, what can you do? Anyway, we're coming really close to the end, but if anyone has any other questions or comments or topics, just hit that push the talk button, give us your first name and call sign.
Yeah. Roy, your 10-meter net on Sunday morning, is there a particular theme to that that event, or is it just general type thing?
It is basically a rag show. I try not to, I do not find the DX contacting to be enjoyable. You'll hear that on 10 meters, especially when 10 meters suddenly opens up and people exchange call signs, they exchange RS codes, and they wish each other well. I like to have chats with people. I particularly enjoyed this morning's chat with Gentleman Les, located in Limerick, Ireland. So it's a generic rag shoe. Next.
Okay, thank you. Excellent. Thank you very much for the answer. KD2VHD.
A quick question? Yeah, certainly. 82 VO Russell. Roy, I didn't know there was a morning 10-meter net. Do you mind telling me the frequency and the time? I might give that a check if I happen to be awake. Certainly. It's done under the auspices of my other club, which is the Kings County Radio Club. It's Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. We try to do it on 28.380 upper sideband, but occasionally, especially now the propagation is so good, if I find someone operating on the frequency or very close to it, where he's going to marry my signal, and it's bad practice, I shift over a little bit. So this morning I was on 28.385. So approximately around 28.380 every Sunday morning starting at 11 a.m.
Well, good to know. I did not know that. I have a 10-meter only radio set up in my vehicle, and I leave for work every day at 1 p.m., and I actually call CQ on 10 meters regularly. And just yesterday, because of the contest, driving into work, I made about 15 pesos on 10 meters just driving into work. So I might wake up a few hours early just to check it out. All right, thanks for that, 82 VO.
Very good, Russell. You're welcome. Everyone out there is welcome. You do not have to be a Kings County Radio Club member to join in. It's sponsored by them. I do it for them. Most Sundays, so the third Sunday of the week, I get off because I'm net control operator for not one, not two, but three nets every month. So that's kind of a long time ago. I remember telling Dick that particular Sunday night, I think I told him I had done four technical nets on different repeaters in that week. Everything kind of lined up in a weird way. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. Hopefully you'll come back and we'll do it all over again. I just want to remind people, if you want to contact me, the email address is mailbag@acqgs.com. My link page, which is available 24/7 and has some illustrations that Paul might mention during the SafeNet report. You can type in your browser roy.ac2gs.com. And the audio stream and is available 24/7 for Glen Oaks. Just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. You'll get there. And keep in mind, MyKC2NJR is a great archive of the Weimar Technical Net going as far back as September 2006. That's located at amateurradio.tv. So keep those all in mind, and I'll be back at the end of the net. But now it's time for the SpaceNet report with full WS2S.
Okay, thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the time. And, yeah, the 10-meter net. The other station said he's going to try every in the morning when he goes to work. Is he under the impression that's every day? Isn't it just on Sunday, Roy?
No, I think he was talking about how he has a 10-meter radio in his car, and when he drives to work at 1 p.m., he goes on there and makes contact. But he said that he'll get up early on a Sunday and to see if he could make a contact with the net.
Get my 7300. Still haven't ordered it. Because my Kenwood 440, I mean, that thing is it's a very good radio, but not too good for 10 meters. You know. 80 and 40, no problem. But I could go all the way up to 10, and there's something wrong with the they go blank. So, anyway, very good work. Let me just stand by, make sure I have it. Okay, and usually I start off with launches and landings that are coming up. There's really one that I'm following tomorrow at around 6 p.m., from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., depending on the window. The Electron rocket made by Rocket Lab is going to take off from Wallops Island, Virginia. And that'll be the first time he launches his rockets from the United States. He's been doing it on a regular basis. I think it's 2017 now. It was his first launch. Probably done 25 or 30 rockets from New Zealand. He now has two launch complexes in New Zealand. And he's been looking to do the same for the United States. At least 2.5 years now it's behind because he could not get a proper licensing from the government. But now he apparently he has it, and tomorrow he'll be able to put his first satellites in from the United States, which would be good. He actually manufactures the rockets and the engines in California, so he'll be able to utilize the East Coast. As well as the New Zealand complex. He also plans on eventually catching these things with a helicopter, the first stage. It has 9 Rutherford engines, so it's nowhere near as big as Falcon 9 by SpaceX, but he does want to reuse them. He's tried to a couple of times off the coast of New Zealand. Comes down, got a parasail on it, and then the helicopter comes along with a hook and supposed to grab it. He's done that twice, but the helicopter couldn't do it. He just released it and let it go. But hopefully he'll be able to do that. If he does, he'll be able to take that, either bring it back to land or most likely bring it back to a ship. And then the ship will bring it back to land. They'll be able to reuse those first stages. But we'll see how Peter Beck is, by the way. He's the name of the owner of Rocket Lab. So we'll see how the Electron rocket does. They call it the Electron rocket. The turbos that spin up, that pump the fuel and oxygen into all the engines, usually are run by pre-burn is, you know, the pressure from their own little rocket engines, and that forces the turbines to spin. He doesn't do that. He has engines, so he's got electric engines tied to each one of these things with big electric motors with lithium-ion batteries, and that's how he spins these turbines up to 100,000 RPM. And it works, he's able to keep the weight down in a much smaller rocket, and he can put payloads up to around 800 pounds into orbit. Any questions before I move on? WS-20. Before I mention the pictures that he put on Y.AC2GS, the two of them that I sent over. By the way, I sent them over on a tablet, so they just look like small pictures. He puts it on his website, and I bring it up on a big computer or a laptop. Boy, those pictures look great. Just terrific. Anyway, the one I sent over is a picture of the Strata Launcher. It's called Strata Launcher. They changed their name to ROC, ROC. Anyway, the original name was Strata Launcher. It's this massive airplane, and the idea is to use this as a carrier for rockets to send into space. It's been under development for 2010, 2011, I think they started. Paul Allen, the co-owner of Microsoft with Bill Gates, he was a billionaire. He had like $20 billion or something when he died. But anyway, he invested money into Strata Launch. And the two fuselage plane with the world's largest wingspan, covering like 285 feet long. And on either side of these two fuselage pieces, you have three engines on one side, three engines on the other side. Well, each engine is engines that really were made for a 747, so each one puts out like 53,000 pounds of thrust. It's a tremendous amount of thrust for this airplane, and you could lift rockets with it. And he had plans of launching Falcon rockets past, and they dropped that idea, and then they were going to fly the Pegasus rocket, which is now, I think they've stopped doing that altogether. Pegasus was being launched by Grumman. They dropped that program. After a while, they said, well, looks like a contract with Sierra Nevada, which developed the Dream Chaser. So there were plans to put that vehicle into space. And that's been canned as well. Although Dream Chaser hasn't. Dream Chaser will probably fly within a year on an Atlas V rocket, vertical launch. So now, Strata Launch, what they've done is they've now contracted with the government to launch hypersonic vehicles. And the first one that they plan on launching is the Talon A. And I read they plan on doing this within a year, maybe 5-6 months from now. And it's a hypersonic vehicle, which means it can fly over 5 times the speed of sound. This vehicle probably between 5 and 10 times the speed of sound, which is a lot. You get up to 5 to 8,000 miles an hour with those kinds of speeds. And the military wants this capability. Now, Talon will launch from straddle launch and eventually hit those speeds and then eventually come back on a runway. That Talon will be reusable. Of course, straddle launch is reusable. The reason I put it on today is last week they flew for their ninth test flight. Paul Allen is gone, but some other company actually picked up the contracts for this, and they continued on. Now, there's only one such vehicle. But, if it all goes well, they should be able to actually have quite a business. The government will launch, quite a few of these hypersonic vehicles. And this thing is so big, you could actually put three of those things on. You could launch three at the same time if you wanted to. So that's the story about straddle launch. I talked about them many years ago, on this net. But now it looks like they're getting rolling again. They run a lot of small tests, get off the ground, fly a little bit, come back down. But this one, they flew 35,000 feet, flew for 6 hours, came back and landed on the runway, and the test facility is out in California, Mojave Desert. Anyway, anybody have any questions?
WB2BX, though.
WB2BXO.
Yeah, I take it the idea of the hypersonic vehicle is this is a hypersonic vehicle that's going to fly within the atmosphere, not something that's going to fly in space, which by definition at orbital and near orbital velocities is hypersonic. Is that right?
That's what I've always said. You could have a hypersonic vehicle that could make it into space, but these that they're doing are designed to be 5 to 10 times the speed of sound. And my understanding was anything over Mach 5 or over, it's considered a hypersonic craft, and I think the military is anxious to get going on this. China has it, Russia has it, and although right now this one is not designed to be a bomb, it's designed for research. When I say this one, I mean the Talon A, they call it. Anyway, back to you, Frank.
Yeah, I would imagine we see the way the Russians have used even their apparently relatively primitive hypersonic weapons in the Ukraine conflict is something that I would imagine that the U.S. and NATO really want to get moving on and rather quickly. Go ahead.
Yes, I've been following that, right. And the Talon A is about 40 feet long, it's got a short wingspan, of course, so kind of 11 feet, you don't need long wings when you're going hypersonic. And the hard part is controlling light. They've done these tests before with some limited success, but with this straddle launch vehicle, they'll be able to do a lot of tests. Really perfect this whole system. It should be good. I'm interested to find out what the military is really going to use it for. I haven't read that yet. We'll see. The wingspan on this thing is around 385 feet. It's longer than the Hercules contraption that Hughes built. know, seen those old documentaries. He built this wooden plane, they said it was made of wood. So the government took the metals were being, were short, you know, you couldn't get metals because of the war. They built it out of wood, and they called it the Spruce Goose. And that, to this day, is the only plane that ever flew with the longest wingspan. Now, this thing's supposed to have a wingspan, I think, I don't know, 70 feet longer than that. So it's pretty cool. Anyway, back to that.
Yeah, very good. I think I saw these Spruce Goose on 4 years ago. Kind of incredible thing for its time. As I recall the story, Howard Hughes sued the government for the right to continue developing it on government money after the war ended, the Defense Department no longer needed it, and he insisted they had a contract and he was going to build it and they were going to pay for it, you know, no matter what. And he got away with it to a point. As I remember the story, he flew, got to test fly this thing, barely, for one flight, and then set it down there in Long Beach with the space to the head.
Yeah, he barely got off the water. It's a watercraft. And I thought what it was, he wasn't going to get paid unless it flew. And so he was so obstinate, he said, okay, I'll fly it myself. You know, he had, you know, a couple of people in there with him, but the story is he flew it back to France.
That sounds like a plausible version of the story, and it was more than, it was my understanding of what happened, but you may be correct. Anyway, it is interesting, this whole hypersonic thing to today is really kind of interesting, and nothing like a war that's for development, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of progress made with this war. Anyway, just wanted to move on to this other topic, Frank, about the European Space Agency and plans of launching a spacecraft this April. You know, it's a little bit over a month away, but a couple of months away. Totally plan on launching it. It's called JUICE. It stands for Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. So they plan on launching this thing to Jupiter. The idea is to actually go into orbit around Jupiter. And as it goes around through its orbit, it will be passing three of the main moons, Ganymede, Europa, Calypso. I don't think it's going to go past Io. Io is too far in. Too much radiation down there. They want to try to keep it away. And the idea is to go into orbit around Jupiter for a number of years, like about 4 years. By the way, it's not going to get there until like 2030. Actually, 2031. I wrote it down there somewhere. Yeah, 2031. And then it will go into orbit and stay there for about three or four years. And then that's the final hurrah. What they plan on doing is actually going into orbit around Ganymede. And Ganymede is similar to Europa. You know, they believe it's got frozen ice all over. And if you dig down below that ice, you have an ocean of water. So, you know, all the scientists would love to get their hands on that, of course. this would be the first time any spacecraft has gone into an orbit around a moon that is not our moon. A moon around a different planet. You know, we've gone into orbit around like an asteroid, and the Dawn spacecraft go into orbit around two asteroids, actually. Wound up eventually going into orbit around Ceres. Still there today. This would be the first time anybody, you know, us, or in this case, the European Space Agency, plan on doing that launch on an Ariane 5 rocket. Now, an Ariane 5 rocket, very, very successful rocket. Like 99% of their flights have been successful. It's a heavy-duty rocket launched by the European Space Agency out of French Guiana, Kourou, French Guiana, where that launch complex is. It's near the equator. And that actually is the same vehicle that launched the James Webb Space Telescope on Christmas, two Christmases ago, and then took 6 months to go get into a proper location a million miles away from Earth. Well, that was the Ariane 5, and now the Ariane 5 is going to launch Juice as well. Hopefully it's successful. They've got like at least 10 instruments on board, you know, spectrometers, cameras. You know, I hope it all works out for scientists. And I mean, it's a long time from now, you know, 2031. But I don't know. We're still here. It'll be fun to see how they do. Not to be outdone the United States. Of course, we have the Europa Clipper, and that will actually launch after Juice launches, but this will be faster. They have a different orbital mechanical system. Juice is going to pass Earth actually three times. In other words, around the Sun three different times. Used to Earth as a gravity assist. Europa Clipper, I think it will have. Not sure if it's going to do any of that. But anyway, that will get there about a year before Juice. And Europa Clipper, they plan on doing orbits around Jupiter as well. But no plan of going into orbit around any of the moons. The idea is to Europa, and each time they go around Jupiter, they're going to go closer and closer to that moon. I was hoping they were going to put a lander on it, but I guess they ran out of money. One time they planned on actually having a lander separate from the Europa Clipper and land on Europa. But it's a very high radiation area when you get near Europa. They have all the electronics inside of the Europa Clipper protected by 1-inch thick titanium walls. They use titanium, this way at least it's light, you know, I mean they can't use lead walls, but titanium is better than nothing. If they were planning on actually having a lander, I don't think they felt comfortable enough, or the weight would have been prohibited to have on a spacecraft like that. You know, when you add weight, that changes everything. The size of the rocket that gets to land, the time it takes to get to a planet, and you know, it just gets out of hand after a while. So they decided not to have a lander. But they plan on getting closer and closer every time they have another orbit. And Europa is, and when you look down at that planet, bring a picture up, it looks like, you know, frozen planet from one end to the other. and they know below that it's definitely an ocean. They said probably more water on Europa. It's, I should say, any deeper than there is on Earth. Really a scientist's dream. If you can get heat, you can get any kind of water, and a salty type of water, the minerals and everything. Their theory is maybe you can get some kind of life, floating around in that ocean. Anyway, we'll see how they do with Juice and with Europa Clipper. Well, actually, this is the future. Any comments? Okay. Nothing heard. Another picture I put on Roy's website, roy.ac2gs, is a picture of a pipeline. Look at it, you say, well, it could be a pipeline anyway, but if you look at the picture close, that pipeline is not on Earth, it's on the Moon. And you look up to the distance and you can see the top of a starship from SpaceX in the distance. So the reason I put that up is NASA is not actually planning on eventually building a pipeline on the Moon. Moon, of course, is believed to have frozen ice down near the poles. Hopefully we've proved that. Well, it's pretty much been proved out, but now we have another spacecraft called Flashlight that's on the way it's going to pass these craters, and it's going to have an infrared laser pointed to the craters. That's in turn is going to confirm that there's frozen ice at the bottom of the craters on the South Pole. The South Pole never sees, the inside of the craters never sees the sun, so any ice that accumulated there at the beginning of time will still be there. And in the future missions after Artemis, starts to really get going and landing flight after flight on the Moon, developing some type of base there. They could eventually, with robots, get this frozen ice out of these craters and then eventually melt them down. Now you have water. Through electrolysis, you could also separate that water. You could have hydrogen for fuel to not only to fuel a rocket, but you might want to fuel your moon base. Fuel cells use hydrogen and oxygen. When you separate the water, you're going to get hydrogen and oxygen. So now you're going to have a large source of oxygen as well. The vehicles, of course, would need liquid oxygen. You don't want to bring all liquid oxygen from Earth. Very expensive. If you can get it off the Moon, pull it in situ, you would be able to utilize that for breathing, rocket fuel. But now, all your fuel will be coming from manufactured really from the South Pole. NASA in the future would not only want to have a base on the South Pole, they would want to have one at the equator, or further north from where they are. Well, you would need oxygen to be brought from the South Pole to those areas. It would be very expensive to take oxygen that you manufacture on the Moon, put it in tanks or tankers, and somehow ship them across the Moon. People, or you need at least equipment. You could do it maybe robotically, but you would need to have the trucks filled with fuel and with oxygen. brought to a faraway area
on the moon.
So the theory is, well, let's have a pipeline. They want to eventually start with, you know, a half mile long pipeline, you know, as a test case. If it works out, then we can extend it in the future. But, you know, I could see it, you know, I could see this, you know, maybe a 2.5 foot diameter pipe going from one end to the other end of the moon, pushing oxygen along. Could have, could all be done, you know, robotically. Any kind of repairs could be done with robotically, but the chance of anything ever happening in this pipeline is nil to none. Once it gets hit with a meteorite, you really don't have moonquakes to any degree that's going to crack this pipe. They plan on making it out of aluminum. Aluminum, there's plenty of aluminum. They figured down on the South Pole. Maybe mine that. As well as magnesium and iron they can get out of as well. But this is what they're thinking about. It should be pretty interesting. Many years from now, of course. In a planning stage, you know, NASA is actually paying for, you know, people to draw this type of thing up. And how would it be done? They don't have to worry about environmental damages like they have to worry about on Earth. If it leaks, you know, it would just go out and get the, out to the vacuum and not bother anybody. Could have robotics go out and fix it, or maybe eventually people figure out a problem and put it back together again. So an aluminum pipe, half a mile long. What do you think about that? I mean, this is what NASA does. You know, it's not like companies like SpaceX or Rocket Lab. You know, they're just building, you know, rockets. And these people have to build infrastructure. You know, what do you think about putting up tank bombs on the moon or with pipes? Pipeline going from one end of the moon to the other. Any comments?
Yeah, WB2BX. So, I don't see NASA getting all that far with this project, and they can only afford to launch the Artemis rocket once every 2 years. I mean, at that rate, when are they going to get this done? 2050?
Well, NASA's going to launch Artemis, they say, roughly every year once they get going. The next one will launch probably about, I'm guessing, a year and a half. And then after that, maybe another year and a half. But once people are there on the first trip, as long as SpaceX has their act together, as long as Gateway is into orbit around the moon, the space station, they plan on eventually doing one every year, and they have plans of doing this for the next 40 years, actually. There's 40 missions that are planned for Artemis. So, somewhere along the line, they could do this. I guess they won't be the only one. Maybe SpaceX will get involved with landing people on the moon. Who knows? Once you have an infrastructure going, you don't know what's going to happen 5, 10, 15 years from now. Who else is going to get involved in it? So it's just literally a pipe dream now, Frank. But I mean, they are getting $23 billion a year for NASA, which does everything. I mean, everything from regular aero you know, airplane, supersonic plane they're developing now, future mission autonomous, keep the international space station going. That costs $4.5 billion a year. So, I mean, one of two things could happen. You know, they could slow down, or they could get more money and speed up. Back to the front.
I guess some of it's going to depend on the level of competition with the, with the Chinese, whether a national security justification, like I guess there was in the Apollo program, that sort of thing, where there was this perception that we had to beat the Russians to the moon. When, it appeared later on that the Russians were primarily interested in building space station, low Earth orbit space station infrastructure. Of course, there was also the problem of their N1 rocket didn't work. Anyway, and I guess a lot is going to depend on whether ultimately SpaceX can demonstrate that the Starship concept is actually workable, because I think that's going to change everything and make Artemis and almost everything else out there obsolete.
Okay, I don't think so. Artemis, as long as they don't have problems with it. Right now, they don't have any problems with space launch systems. I think it's going to be very competitive, no matter who gets involved. China, India wants to do this eventually. They plan on launching a crew into space, into orbit within a year or two. China definitely wants to go to the moon. They have satellite out there now that they communicate with another vehicle that they have on the moon right now, riding around on the so-called dark side of the moon. Their goal is to have people, astronauts, that's what they call them, their idea of astronauts land on the moon. Our country, slow down and let them all take over? I don't think so. No matter who's in office. Private companies could have money problems. They could go downhill. Who knows what's going to happen? SpaceX is doing good now, but, he's got other businesses that could drag it down. NASA is like, they've got every state in the country with contractors for the space program. So, I mean, politically, that's the way to go. That's how they manage to get support, no matter who's in office. You cut the space from program, and you're going to cut jobs from different states. You don't want 70, but that's what happened to me. I was thinking about pipelines. When I got back in the 70s, I had gone through an apprenticeship, and totally involved with pipe welding. And one of the openings in the future, in the near future, when I got out, was the Alaskan pipeline. Hear a tone on that one. Anyway, getting very close to doing that, but local 798, they handle all the welding on the Alaska pipeline. Although I could have signed up with one of the other locals that did the one of the 10 pumping stations. But by the time I got out of the apprenticeship, that thing was starting to wind down. But I don't know, another year earlier I could have gotten involved. interesting pipeline. 4 foot diameter pipe from one of, end of Alaska to the other, 800 miles long. Any comments? Anyway, by the way, if you ever see pictures of the Alaska pipeline, it's riding on these H type of stanchions, that, you know, one right after the other. And you look at the top, and you wonder why they have radiators, aluminum radiators, sticking out of the top of every single stanchion. You know, the pipe is 40 foot long. One has a couple of expansions underneath. So what those radiators are doing, that they're attached to other aluminum pipes that go down into the ground into the permafore. And it actually keeps the ground from starting to force. You know, if that happens, next thing you know, you have expansions, you know, you start to move or collapse. So you actually have what's called a passive refrigeration system on each one. So you don't need a compressor or anything. It's just got ammonia and two pipes, one going up and one going down. It just recirculates automatically. Interesting project. Any comments? Anyway, if they build a pipeline on the moon, I hope they get the guys from Oklahoma, local 798, send them up to the moon and do it. They would do it. They were characters. Let me see if there's any other comments before I move on. This is WS20.
Look for, I think it was on Netflix, Netflix or Amazon, Steve Carroll's Space Force parody. Very funny, with a Space Force sends plumbers to the moon. You'll get a kick out of that. WB2BX.
Do they have another season?
Time complete.
Saw a couple of episodes. Did they have another season come out?
There were, what, two seasons of it. I don't think there's been a third season. I think there were two seasons of it.
Okay. I'll have to continue on. I guess I stopped. That was pretty, very funny. It was a very funny show. That was Netflix. You're right, Netflix. Anyway, I was going to talk about European. I just talked about that, right? The EVA, that was just done. I talked about this before, so I'm not going to go on and on about it. But we had two people do an EVA last week. On the International Space Station. And the Coleman and Kawachi with Wakata, the guy from Japan. And they successfully installed some equipment, getting ready for more ROSAs, or International Space Station rollout solar arrays. That's an ongoing project. One complete setup is done. They're going to do another one. They're in the middle of this one, and then another one about a year or so from now. So that's successful. And you're going to have another launch going up very shortly as well. to the International Space Station by SpaceX, a crew of four. And they'll be joining the crew of seven that are up there, and four of them will come back.